Hey, Mike here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Dark Poutine early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
Well, welcome back to Dark Poutine. I am Mike Brown, and I see Matthew Stockton.
You do.
We just ate at the Jerusalem Grill. It was really, really nice.
Shawarma.
It was so good. Oh, my gosh. And the guy was a little freaked out, I think, when I said shukran on leaving, because that's thank you in Arabic. And he said a whole string of words that I didn't understand, thinking I knew more Arabic than I actually
then
do.
Then you scuttled out the door.
Yeah, scuttled. Anyway.
The views, information, and opinions expressed during the Dark Poutine podcast are solely those of the producer and do not necessarily represent those of Curious Cast, its affiliate Global News, nor its parent company, Chorus Entertainment.
Dark Poutine is not for the faint of heart or squeamish. Our content is often intense and some listeners may find it disturbing. We are not experts on the topics we present, nor are we journalists. We are ordinary Canadian schmucks chatting about crime and the dark side of history. Let's get to it. Put on your toque, grab yourself a double-double and a Nanaimo bar. It's time to scarf down some Dark Poutine.
You are responsible for obtaining and maintaining at your own cost all equipment needed to listen to Dark Poutine. Dark Poutine can be addictive. Side effects may include, but not be limited to, pausing and questioning the system, elevated heart rate, pondering humanity, odd looks from colleagues as you laugh out loud at work, family members not into true crime worrying about you. Positive side effects may include some perspectives and opinions that you disagree with, as well as some wokeness and empathy. If you don't think Dark Poutine is for you, consult your doctor immediately.
Having just set out from Quebec City the previous day, in the early hours of May 29, 1914, the passenger ship Empress of Ireland sank in the St. Lawrence River near Rimouski, Quebec. She was on a return trip to Liverpool, England, and due to heavy fog, the ship collided with the Norwegian collier SS Storstad. Just 2 years after the Titanic calamity in international waters off the coast of Nova Scotia came the deadliest shipwreck in Canadian history. The event was so significant, it is number 11 on the list of deadliest all-time Canadian disasters, just behind 10, which is the Halifax explosion. The collision occurred when most of the 1,057 passengers and 420 crew members were fast asleep. The aftermath was devastating. The liner plummeted beneath the waters in less than 15 minutes, resulting in the tragic loss of more than 1,000 lives. This is Dark Poutine episode 270, The Empress of Ireland Disaster. Leading up to the First World War, in the early 20th century, there was a significant wave of immigration from the UK and Europe to Canada, driven by many factors and heavily contributed to the shaping of modern-day Canada. Imagine this, the comfort of your home recedes into the horizon as you embark on a life-altering journey to an entirely new country. This wasn't just fantasy. It was the lived reality for 2.5 million individuals who between 1904 and 1913 left the familiar landscapes of Europe to begin anew in the sprawling vastness of Canada. Their voyage to new beginnings was initiated on the decks of ships like the Empress of Ireland, and other grand vessels were the first chapters of their Canadian story. The major reasons for the immigration were economic opportunities. Canada was promoted as a land of great economic opportunity at the time. The Canadian government and businesses were actively recruiting UK and European workers to fill labor shortages in various industries such as farming, mining, and logging. Land availability. The Dominion Lands Act of 1872 offered inexpensive or even free land to settlers willing to establish farms on the Canadian prairies. This was a significant draw for people from the UK, where land was much more scarce and expensive. Improved transportation. The development of transatlantic steamships and Canadian railways made it easier and more affordable for people to travel to and within Canada. The Canadian Pacific Railway, completed in 1885, was particularly important in opening up Western Canada to settlement. Family and community connections. Many people emigrated to join family or community members who'd already settled in Canada. These established networks could provide support and assistance to new immigrants. Political and social stability. Compared to other parts of the world, Canada was seen as politically stable and socially tolerant, attracting immigrants seeking to escape political or religious persecution. And finally, push factors. In addition to the pull factors attracting people to Canada, there were also push factors driving people away from the UK and Europe. These included unemployment, low wages, lack of social mobility, and crowded living conditions, particularly in urban areas. As transoceanic passenger flight was still years away and Charles Lindbergh's famous transatlantic flight didn't happen until 1927, the main mode of travel for immigrants to the New World was by ship, as it had been for centuries. The period leading up to World War I was a transformative era for ocean liners, reflecting wider trends in technology, society, and global politics. So it's interesting, you know, here we are less than 100 years from Charles Lindbergh's flight.
Right.
And we've got like all this stuff in our lives now.
Yes.
You know, that wasn't even a pipe dream at the time.
Technology builds on itself pretty quickly.
Yeah, isn't it fascinating?
I think, wonder when the time will come when everyone's like, remember when we used to travel just on Earth?
Right.
Yeah.
Or do you remember when we actually had to wait in line and get into a big metal tube that flew across instead of that amazing transporter that we have now?
Transporter.
Oh, yeah. And then you become fused with a fly and that's that.
That's not good.
No. Ocean liners played a pivotal role in the mass migrations of the early 20th century, transporting millions of immigrants from Europe to North America. They revolutionized long-distance travel, drastically reducing transatlantic travel time from weeks to days. These factors drove significant technological advances in ocean travel. This era witnessed the transformation from coal-powered steamships to more efficient oil-powered steam turbines. This shift increased speed and reduced labor intensity in ship operations. The introduction of double hulls and watertight compartments added an extra layer of safety. The race for the fastest transatlantic crossing led to the unofficial competition known as the Blue Riband. Pursuing this accolade spurred continuous improvements in ship design and engine technology. In 1914, the time of the Empress of Ireland disaster, the RMS Mauritania held the Blue Riband for the fastest transatlantic crossing. The ship, operated by the Cunard Line, had seized the title in 1909 and maintained it until 1929. Marking the longest duration that any ship had held the Blue Riband up to that point. The Mauritania's record-setting westward crossing in 1909 had an average speed of approximately 26.06 knots, approximately 48.26 kilometers per hour, or 30 miles per hour, and it completed the crossing in just under 4 days and 10 hours. This was a significant achievement at the time and reflected the advancements in ocean liner design and technology. Ocean liners also became symbols of national pride, and intense competition emerged to create the largest and most luxurious ships. New amenities such as electric lighting, telephones, elevators, and heated swimming pools were introduced. First-class accommodations evolved to resemble luxurious floating palaces, boasting grand dining rooms, opulent staircases, and lavish staterooms. The Titanic disaster in 1912 served as a grim wake-up call, leading to considerable enhancements in maritime safety regulations. This included the introduction of requirements for sufficient lifeboats, the implementation of regular lifeboat drills, and the establishment of 24-hour radio communication. The Empress of Ireland and her sister ship, the Empress of Britain, were the inaugural passenger liners constructed specifically to cater to the escalating immigrant business of the Canadian Pacific Line under the Canadian Pacific Railway, CPR, bridging Liverpool and Canada. Launching their weekly services from Liverpool in May and June 1906, respectively, these two empresses stood out amongst their competition. With their larger size, superior speed, and enhanced comfort, they swiftly ascended to become the vessels of choice on this transatlantic route.
So that's interesting. So the CPR right, was right across Canada.
Right.
And all those built great hotels
were
built, like the Royal York, and those are all CP Railway hotels. And they had that ocean liner. I had no idea they had an ocean liner as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really neat.
So you can connect from Liverpool all the way across Canada.
Yep.
Right? Through CPR.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really great. A great business idea.
I wonder why they didn't call it Canadian Atlantic. You know, because like think of Virgin and Virgin Atlantic.
Well, they're going all the way to the Pacific.
That's true.
And the company was already called Canadian Pacific, so they probably didn't want to confuse anybody. From the Library and Archives Canada site, quote, "The RMS Empress of Ireland was launched on January 27, 1906, as part of the Canadian Pacific Railway Company's Empress line of steamships, which carried passengers and cargo across the North Atlantic between Britain and Canada. She was 550 feet, 167 meters long, weighed 14,191 tons, and her two propellers produced a service speed of 18 knots, 33 miles an hour, or 53 kilometers per hour. She had five passenger decks, as well as a boat deck, and could accommodate up to 1,700 passengers and crew. Mail was an important cargo for the Empress of Ireland, and as such, she earned the prefix RMS Royal Mail Ship for her maiden voyage from Liverpool in June 1906. End quote. Throughout her 8-year tenure, from 1906 to 1914, the Empress of Ireland transported a significant number of 186,848 passengers between Liverpool and Quebec. Most of her westbound voyagers were British and Scandinavian immigrants dreaming of new beginnings in Canada, with many destined for the Canadian prairies. The once arduous journey was considerably eased by the Canadian Pacific Railway's advantageous combined ship and railway ticketing. Known for her elegance, the Empress of Ireland extended modern conveniences to her first, second, and third class guests. A notable amenity was the state-of-the-art Marconi Company wireless telegraph apparatus on board. This groundbreaking wireless technology enabled operators to transmit and receive messages over distances of 400 miles during the day and up to 2,000 miles at night. The ship's interior showcased refined elegance, particularly the first-class dining room, adorned with Art Nouveau-inspired motif. The Empress earned a reputation for reliability, safety, and ensuring a delightful journey for her guests. Notably, comfort wasn't exclusive to the higher classes. Even third-class passengers found their accommodations pleasingly cozy. Passengers and crew were well supplied for the 6-day crossings. Among the food supplies were 10,800 eggs, 4,400 kilograms of beef, lamb, veal, and pork, 3,500 kilograms of flour, 2,000 liters of milk and cream, 1,000 kilograms of rice, 1,000 kilograms of fresh fruit, 250 kilograms of cheese, and 250 kilograms of sugar. According to an archived article at the Royal Albert Museum, passengers felt they were living la belle vie, the good life. Quote, "Deck life was the most exciting part of the transatlantic voyage. When on deck, guests could go for a stroll, catch a breath of fresh air, or engage in discussions with other passengers. On a pleasant day, the decks were filled with guests playing shuffleboard. Stewards planned large group games and activities for passengers in each class as well. Organized activities included skipping or whistling competitions, as well as tug-of-war and apple-bobbing games. While each class was entertained, they did not interact with one another. Indoor activities included reading in the library, writing letters, or playing cards. In later years, passengers enjoyed the cinematograph or film,
that was shown using a hand-cranked projector. Each class was treated to light concerts by the Empress's professional musicians and passengers. Performances included songs and recitations and ended with the singing of national anthems, end quote. Above all, the Empress assured her passengers of a comfortable journey with the peace of mind that came with her outstanding safety record. The ship held the highest safety classification, Lloyd's Class Star 100 A1, earning her a reputation for reliability. Additional safety regulations were introduced in response to the Titanic catastrophe in 1912, further enhancing the safety features aboard the Empress. The Empress underwent a series of upgrades in response to fresh legislation advocating for enhanced maritime safety. Higher davits, the cranes responsible for handling lifeboats, were installed to conform with these new standards. An additional safety measure included placing a collapsible craft beneath each lifeboat, increasing the number of available life-saving vessels. Moreover, the ship was also stocked with an ample supply of extra life jackets. The luxurious ship had hosted a few extremely famous passengers for earlier successful Atlantic crossings. They included Guglielmo Marconi, the Italian inventor and electrical engineer known for pioneering long-distance radio transmission work. Marconi developed the first practical radio signaling system, which was used for long-distance communication, effectively making him the father of long-distance radio communication. His development of a radio telegraph system allowed wireless communication between ships at sea, between islands, and eventually between the European and American continents. As mentioned previously, Marconi's wireless was a prominent amenity aboard the Empress. In 1909, Marconi was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics, which he shared with Carl Ferdinand Braun in recognition of their contributions to the development of wireless telegraphy.
I still remember learning about Marconi in public school.
Yeah.
Because, of course, he was on Signal Hill in St. John's, Newfoundland. I assume they named it Signal Hill after the fact.
After that, yeah.
Hey, there's a place in Canada called Signal Hill. This would be a good spot to do it.
Yeah.
The first transatlantic radio message was sent from there.
I don't remember learning much about Marconi. Of course, it could have been pushed out of my brain.
Probably.
But I do recall learning about it later on, but I don't recall it in school. It was probably taught to me. I wasn't paying attention.
Just glazed over.
Thinking
about Jimi Hendrix or something.
Something like that. Another passenger was Robert Baden-Powell, 1st Baron Baden-Powell. And Baden-Powell was a British Army officer, writer, and founder of the worldwide scouting movement. He became a national hero in Britain for his 217-day defense of Mafeking. In the South African War, also known as the Boer War. However, he is best known for founding the Boy Scouts in 1908 and the Girl Guides in 1910 with his sister, Agnes Baden-Powell. Baden-Powell's book, Scouting for Boys, served as a guide for these organizations and remains one of the all-time best-selling books in the English language. He passed away on January 18th, 1941.
Now, hikers in Vancouver will recognize that name because there's a hiking trail named after him on the North Shore.
Yeah, and it stretches all the way from Deep Cove to Lions Bay,
yeah,
I believe.
Lions Bay.
Yeah.
And our UK listeners will remember that he's the dude with all the controversy a few years back when the Bournemouth, Christchurch, and Poole Council planned on removing the statue because it was going to be targeted.
Wow.
But then other...
Targeted, but for what?
Various things. So some people are calling him a war criminal.
Yeah.
Some people are calling him homophobic. Some people are calling him a pedophile. Some people were saying that he was a friend of Hitler. So it was one of these...
And you got to sift through whether or not any of that is actual fact.
I read some of it, and I think, honestly, with this dude, I think it was just kind of on the list and a bit of a push, if I'm honest with you. But, you know, back then in the 1800s, war was sort of different. And anyone who was ever in any war would be considered a war criminal,
in my opinion,
right?
Yeah. Rudyard Kipling was a British author and poet born in 1865. He traveled on the Empress of Ireland and he's best known for his works of fiction, including The Jungle Book, Kim, and his poems, such as If. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1907, making him the first English language writer to receive that prize. A few notables among the 87 first-class passengers who boarded the Empress in Quebec City for what would be the Empress of Ireland's final voyage to Liverpool, listed in no particular order, were Henry Lyman, the leader of Lyman, Sons & Co., Canada's most substantial pharmaceutical company as of 1914. He was traveling to Europe with his young wife, Florence, for a long-awaited honeymoon. Lawrence Irving, son of the esteemed Victorian stage actor Sir Henry Irving. Since 1912, Lawrence and his wife and stage partner Mabel Hackney had been on an extended theatrical tour of Australia and North America. Colonel Robert Bloomfield from New Zealand's 3rd Mounted Regiment was aboard with his wife Isabella and their daughter Hilda. George Smart, the inspector of British Immigration Children and Receiving Homes. Lieutenant Colonel Charles Tiley of the Canadian Army, accompanied by his wife Martha. Sir Henry Seton Carr, former member of the British House of Commons, was returning from a hunting trip in BC. And Wallace Palmer, an associate editor for the Financial Times, was traveling with his wife, Ethel.
So notable, but not super prominent people on the world stage.
That's right.
Yeah.
Captain Henry George Kendall was commanding the Empress and was recently elevated to this role. Although new to this ship, Kendall was no landlubber. He had only been with the ship for a month, but was already well-respected by the ship's seasoned crew. The old man, a common nickname for a ship's captain, was a master mariner with 25 years of experience and had an excellent handle on what needed doing aboard the ship. Like many captains, Kendall did have a series of unfortunate events in his career. Before the Empress of Ireland tragedy, he had been involved in an incident in 1907 where the ship he was commanding, the SS Montrose, collided with another ship. Then, in 1912, while still commanding the Montrose, he reported the murderous fugitives Dr. Holly Harvey Crippen and his wife to the authorities, leading to Crippen's arrest. Upon his capture, a furious Dr. Crippen cursed Captain Kendall for turning him in. After the sinking of the Empress, a few pointed toward what came to be known as the Crippen Curse as one of the disaster's causes. I am planning an entire episode on Dr. Crippen, the first criminal ever captured, thanks to the help of wireless telegraphy.
I know that story of Dr. Crippen, and it'd be a really interesting podcast to do. I call him a psychopathic homeopath.
Oh, dear. Adding to the intrigue, the disappearance of Emmy, the ship's cat aboard the Empress of Ireland, is particularly interesting. Since ancient times, the practice of having a ship's cat on board was mainly for vermin control, but also the added benefit of companionship for lonely crew members at sea for weeks. Rats, mice, and other vermin can destroy important infrastructure on board seagoing vessels, chewing on ropes, electrical wires, and woodwork, not to mention food stores or cargo like grain. As it is widely believed that rat fleas on trade ships were the main carriers of the Black Death across the globe, having a kitty on board also helped to prevent the spread of disease. Cats were traditionally seen in maritime folklore as having protective supernatural powers over ships and their crew against hazardous weather. Some fishermen's wives even kept black cats at home, hoping these creatures would protect their husbands at sea. A cat approaching a sailor on deck was deemed lucky, but if it retreated halfway, it was seen as a bad omen. There was also a belief that cats could conjure storms using magic stored in their tails.
That's nothing. Steve can conjure farts using magic in his tail.
I think it's gas in the area underneath his tail.
I tell you, it's worse than a storm, a bulldog fart.
I have smelled one of Steve's farts.
They're special, aren't they?
They are unpleasant. Emmy was a friendly female tabby cat who'd been with the Empress almost from the ship's launch. While in port in Quebec City, Emmy, who'd recently had a litter of kittens, began acting strangely. She jumped ship while the Empress was at the dock, ran down the gangplank, and made for the shore. The crew chased her down before she could flee further into the port and brought her back aboard. But in the hours leading up to the Empress casting off from the dock, Emmy snuck off, leaving her kittens behind, and was never seen again by the ship's crew. Superstitious sailors see losing a ship's cat as a particularly bad omen. They believe that if a ship's cat disappears or is accidentally or intentionally cast overboard, it will invoke a fierce storm that might sink the ship. And even if the ship were to survive the storm, losing the ship's cat was believed to cause 9 years of bad luck for the ship and her hapless crew. Perhaps Emmy's departure was an omen of the pending tragedy. Maybe she knew something that the human members of the crew did not.
Now I'm stressed about the kittens.
Of course, yeah, like what? What about the kittens? And I don't think they survived.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Why is it when I watch fictional shows, I'm fine with people getting slaughtered, like in a horror film?
Yeah.
But if somebody touches a dog or a cat, I get, like, I literally shut off the show.
A friend of mine told me that she won't watch a show if she knows that the cat is going to die.
Well, I've been, like, watching The X-Files with Justin.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, they are quite willy-nilly with the killing of dogs on that show.
Oh, no.
Even Scully's dog, Queequeg, was eaten by an alligator.
Queequeg? Oh, little hearkening to Moby Dick.
Yeah,
there.
Her dog's name was Queequeg.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. And the poor little thing was eaten by an alligator. Spoiler alert, you think it's a monster that gets them, but it was...
Yeah, spoiler alert for a show in the 1990s.
Well, some of us are just watching it for the first time.
Oh, dear.
It jumped the shark in season 4.
Oh, it really jumped the shark in season 10.
As soon as they did the cops episode,
oh,
bad boys, bad boys.
Oh, no.
I was like, we're like, this is over.
According to the Library and Archives Canada site, under a cloudless sky on May 28, 1914 at 4:30 p.m., the Empress of Ireland embarked from Quebec City with 1,477 individuals on board, 1,057 passengers, and 420 crew. Meanwhile, the SS Storstad, a coal-laden collier, journeyed up the river. Her mission? Deliver a hefty cargo of 10,400 tons of coal to Montreal. Constructed in Newcastle-on-Tyne, England, this vessel was the property of a Norwegian shipowner named Klaveness. The Storstad, measuring 135 meters in length and 17.5 meters in breadth, had a draft of 7.5 meters. A mere 1.2 meters of the hull rested above water, and the ship could reach a top speed of 10 knots. Designed according to the Isherwood principle, with longitudinal beams running stem to stern and a sharp, reinforced bow for ice navigation, the Storstad posed a considerable threat in the event of a collision. The Empress stopped in Rimouski to pick up mail, proceeding to Father Point. It was here at 1:20 a.m. that the pilot, Adelard Bernier, disembarked, casually remarking as he descended the rope ladder, "I don't think you'll run into much fog." From then on, the Empress of Ireland was on her own to navigate back to Liverpool. Kendall ordered full steam ahead at 1:30 a.m. and headed northeast to the channel plotted on the ship's maps. More after a quick break.
Sergeant and Mr. Smith, you're gonna love this house.
Bunk beds in a closet?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
And we are back. Matthew, thoughts so far?
You know, when you told me you were doing this story, I had to look it up because sure. I'd never heard of it.
Isn't that strange? Yeah.
Right? And inevitably, I compare it to the Titanic.
Mm-hmm. You'd have to.
Which is really deeply in our collective consciousness, right?
Yep.
And I don't know why this story isn't so well known like the Titanic is.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, Mike, in many ways, it's way more gripping. It's way more dramatic than a ship hitting a iceberg.
Yeah.
Right? So cinematically, if you want to make a movie of it, it'd actually be pretty good. And over 1,000 people died on both, right? Approximately 1,500 of the Titanic, and they think around 1,012 on the Empress.
Right.
But I think let's talk at the end of the show a little bit about the difference and why maybe one story was so much bigger than the other.
Okay, yeah, let's. Aboard the Storstad, on the evening of May 28th at approximately 9:30 p.m., Captain Thomas Anderson retreated to his cabin accompanied by his wife. He left his first mate, Alfred Toftennis, in command, with explicit instructions to rouse him when they were 10 kilometers from Pointe au Père, or in the event of fog. The deck was manned by 5 crew members from a total of 36. The night sky was crystal clear as the clock neared 1 a.m. on May 29, 1914. According to witnesses, lookouts on both ships, the Empress and Storstad, spotted each other simultaneously around 1:40 a.m. They were 8 miles apart at that point. Kendall's plan for navigating the passing of the ship was to follow the rules of the road. The Empress of Ireland would cross paths with the coal ship at a safe distance, mirroring its course to facilitate a starboard-to-starboard, green-to-green passing, devoid of any risk. Upon reaching a parallel position, Kendall directed an eastward course, keeping the mast, headlight, and the green light of the other ship in sight. The Empress of Ireland's departing pilot, Bernier, couldn't have been more wrong in his weather assessment. At around 1:50 a.m., Kendall observed a dense fog bank rolling in rapidly from the south shore, obscuring the space between the two vessels. When they were enveloped in the fog, Kendall commanded full astern, intending to halt the ship's progress and allow the heavily laden collier to pass safely.
I was just going to say that, like, you know, I'm so into, like, what's going on right now. Like, hey, wouldn't it be just smart, just stop?
Yep.
Like, just, whoa, hold on, everybody.
And right? But stopping a ship isn't that easy.
But I'd be, like, pumping the brakes.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much what Captain Kendall did. Aboard the Storstad, Toftennis had assumed that the ships would pass port to port, red on red, going against the rules of the road. They slowed to a stop, and once stationary, the current started to push the ship to the left. Assuming the other ship was on that side, he turned starboard to counteract the current's force. He ordered the engine slow ahead. Feeling anxious, he summoned Captain Anderson. A white and green light emerged from the fog as Anderson stepped onto the bridge. The passenger ship was directly in their path, and a collision was inevitable. Anderson commanded full astern, but it was too late. The third whistle blast hung in the air when the two ships collided. Back on the Empress in the moments before the collision, once the ship had come to a halt, Captain Kendall gave the command for 2 long blasts of the whistle, intending to alert the other vessel. The coal ship responded with 1 prolonged blast, disconcertingly close. Kendall's nerves spiked, and he peered into the fog from the starboard bridge wing, searching for signs of the other ship. Suddenly, the looming figure of the Storstad emerged from the fog only 30 meters, 100 feet away. It appeared a collision was inevitable. In a desperate bid to mitigate the impending disaster, he commanded full speed ahead. The Storstad hit the Empress of Ireland with a humongous, deafening crash and squeal of twisting metal at a 45-degree angle, the point of impact being the ship's center near the bridge. Captain Kendall bellowed into the voice pipe, urging them not to reverse the engines in an attempt to maintain the ship's stability. Water began pouring into the tremendous gaping hole in the Empress of Ireland. The time was 1:55 in the morning on May 29, 1914. The historical record indicates that the SS Storstad and the RMS Empress of Ireland communicated via whistle signals and visual sightings rather than through wireless radio communication in the moments leading up to the collision. The foggy conditions impaired visibility, making it difficult to ascertain the other ship's position and intentions. It is important to note that even though wireless radio technology was available in 1914, not all ships were equipped with it, and even if they were, it was not necessarily used for routine communication between vessels in close proximity. Additionally, usage depended on the presence of trained wireless operators. Although Bernier had said it was unlikely, it was exactly fog, the age-old enemy of sailors for eons, that played a major role in the ship's sinking. A dense fog set in, dramatically reducing visibility and making navigation in the unmarked channels even more difficult. The development of radar, radio detection and ranging technology in the 1930s, and its use aboard ships during World War II in the 40s, finally gave sailors a fighting chance to avoid deadly collisions and dense fog. But in 1914, the detection of potential threats was left to radio communication with other vessels, accurate maps, knowledge of other ships in the area, and the keen, watchful eyes of the ship's crew. With the confusion aboard both ships about the procedure to follow in the dense fog, the accident was unavoidable. The Storstad, save for a crumpled bow, was relatively undamaged and not taking on water. The Empress, on the other hand, was in a dire way. She was sinking, and quickly. As it dawned on him that his ship was doomed, Kendall issued orders to secure all watertight hatches and doors and to ready all lifeboats. The fateful strike had landed just behind bulkhead number 5, which divided the two boiler rooms. Stewards rushed to rouse all passengers, hand out life jackets, and guide them to their assigned lifeboat stations. The severe starboard tilt and the impact force made it impossible to close most of the watertight doors. With 1 foot braced against the bulkhead and the other on the sloping deck, the wireless operator Ferguson sent out an SOS. Many passengers were jolted awake by the incline and the chilling touch of water seeping into their cabins. With less than 10 hours of familiarity with the ship, most stumbled blindly toward their lifeboat stations. Some portside steel lifeboats broke free, crashing into and injuring passengers at their starboard stations. Amid the chaos, a few boats managed to be successfully launched into the water. The ship made a full starboard roll 10 minutes after the calamitous impact. Its two enormous yellow and black funnels hit the water, crushing one of the lifeboats. Many passengers, including Captain Kendall, were cast into the chilling waters. Kendall managed to swim towards a collapsible lifeboat. Only 14 minutes after the collision, the Empress of Ireland slipped beneath the cold, dark waters of the St. Lawrence. Of the 1,477 passengers and crew who'd set sail from Quebec City, tragically, only 465 individuals survived. The fortunate survivors who endured the ordeal were plucked from the ocean by nearby ships, including the Storstad. Additionally, local residents from Rimouski and nearby areas mobilized to aid in the rescue mission. They brought boats and assisted in rescuing survivors struggling in the water or clinging to debris. The survivors received dry clothing, warm blankets, nourishment, and medical attention in Rimouski. Meanwhile, the lifeless bodies salvaged from the wreckage were stored in a boat shed. The search for bodies persisted on the river for several days, attracting global attention as the incident unfolded. The Storstad, the vessel responsible for the collision, continued its voyage to Montreal with its bow severely damaged. The tragic event claimed the lives of 1,012 passengers and crew members, making it the largest maritime disaster in Canadian history. Among the 1,057 passengers were 138 children and approximately 170 members of the Salvation Army en route to a conference in London. Tragically, 840 passengers lost their lives, leaving only 217 surviving. Among the young ones, only 4 children managed to survive, while around 124 members of the Salvation Army perished in the disaster. The loss of the Empress has always been overshadowed by the Titanic and Lusitania disasters. However, more passengers died on the Empress than on the Lusitania, where 786 passengers died, or even on the Titanic, where 817 passengers perished. Regarding the crew, consisting of 420 individuals, 172 tragically lost their lives, while 248 were fortunate enough to survive. In June, the Canadian Pacific Railway, CPR, the owners of the Empress of Ireland, made efforts to salvage the valuable cargo, mailbags, and bodies from the sunken vessel. However, due to the ship's position on the seabed, the dive team could not refloat the ship as originally planned. Consequently, the decision was made to employ dynamite to open the cargo holds, enabling the recovery of valuable items and approximately 250 bodies. On June 16, 1914, a royal commission was promptly initiated in Quebec to investigate the circumstances surrounding the rapid sinking of the Empress of Ireland. Chaired by Lord Mersey, its primary objective was to ascertain responsibility and determine the underlying causes of the tragic event. Over the course of several weeks, extensive testimonies were heard, and a staggering 8,000 questions were posed by lawyers representing both sides. Ultimately, the commission reached a conclusion that navigational errors had been committed by both ships involved. Additionally, Blame was attributed to Alfred Toftennis, the first mate of the Storstad, for failing to notify his captain during the foggy conditions. Kendall was cleared of any responsibility for the disaster. Regarding the Swift sinking, it became apparent that a crucial factor was related to the management of watertight doors. In its recommendations, the Commission proposed several measures to improve safety in the future. These included the mandatory closure of all watertight doors and portholes at night and in fog, and ensuring that lifeboats were readily available on the upper decks for easy deployment in the event of a sinking. Furthermore, the Commission suggested establishing an alternative approach to the pilot stations to prevent ships from crossing paths in such proximity. After the outbreak of World War I, a month after the Commission into the sinking of the Empress, she was forgotten for a time as the world's attention turned to more pressing matters. It wasn't until the mid-60s that divers returned to the wreck, marked by a single buoy. The unsanctioned salvage divers found things aboard the wreck that had been untouched for decades. Over the next 30 years, divers recovered thousands of items from the wreck, which were put up for sale and auction. Many felt the looting of the Empress of Ireland was disrespectful to those who'd lost their lives and to the families who remembered them. According to the 100-year commemorative site, empress2014.ca, quote, "In 1998, an expedition that would have resulted in the destruction of part of the wreck drew attention. Several local citizens petitioned the federal and provincial governments to assure the protection of the Empress of Ireland. On April 15, 1999, Quebec's Minister of Culture and Communications classified the wreck in the category Historical and Archaeological Property, thus showing its great symbolic and commemorative value as the biggest maritime tragedy in the history of Canada. This protected status prohibits any intervention or salvaging of artifacts from the ship." In the spring of 1999, the Canadian Coast Guard moored a white buoy near the wreck, thus indicated that it is a protected site. Diving on the wreck is still permitted as long as the divers respect the regulations outlined in the Cultural Property Act. Thanks to the generosity of these divers, many of the salvaged items may be viewed by the public. They bear witness to the tragedy, allowing the memory of the Empress of Ireland to live on. End quote. Various memorials and commemorations have been established to honor the victims of the Empress of Ireland. These include memorials in Rimouski, Quebec, where the ship sank, and in Liverpool, England, and other locations connected to the victims and the vessel. The sinking of the Empress of Ireland has had a lasting cultural impact. It has been the subject of books, documentaries, and artistic works, keeping the memory of the disaster alive and raising awareness about maritime safety. The Empress of Ireland disaster prompted significant changes in maritime safety protocols. It influenced the implementation of stricter regulations for watertight compartments, lifeboats, and navigational practices, aiming to prevent similar tragedies in the future. Captain Kendall went on to see action during World War I. In March 1918, his ship, the HMS Calgarian, was torpedoed off the Ulster coast by German submarine U-19. But Kendall survived yet another sinking. At the age of 91, he passed away in a nursing home in England in 1965. Surprisingly, his obituary in the Times did not reference the tragic sinking of the Empress of Ireland. However, nurses who cared for Kendall during his final moments shared that he appeared to be experiencing vivid recollections of a shipwreck as he experienced his distress while in a state of delirium. Wow.
He would have held on to that for a long time.
Sure.
Right? You're the captain of the ship and over 1,000 people die?
Yeah. Well, you would have to. Yeah, I mean.
You'd carry that forever.
Even though he was deemed not responsible.
Yeah, you'd still carry it because you would feel responsible.
Yeah, totally. You think you would second guess yourself pretty much for the rest of your life. What could you have done differently to save 1,012 lives?
Yeah.
1,000 people.
And 12.
I mean, yeah, but having that many people die under
your watch,
that can't have been an easy thing to live with. So you wanted to talk about why you think this story wasn't as popular or isn't as popular in the public consciousness as the Titanic story.
Because it's huge.
It is huge.
I've never heard of it. Mike. Right. And this is like in Canadian waters, right? And I'm Canadian and I'd never heard of it.
Well, I think... Before you go, I'm thinking the Titanic was unsinkable, you know, they called her unsinkable. So that might have been one of the things that sort of added to the mythology around it. But I'll let you go into it here.
Well, because I actually sat down and thought this through. Right?
Okay.
Because I was like, for my own head, I wanted to understand. You know the New York Times slogan, all the news that's fit to print?
Yes.
In the joke, all the news that fits.
Right. Yeah. Well, all that fits on the page.
It's
yeah.
timing and context. So the Titanic sank in April of 1912.
Right.
In a peaceful time.
Right.
With lots of stability. So there's a lot of room to focus on the tragedy.
Right. Right.
The Empress sank just a few weeks before the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, which lit World War I.
Correct.
Right. Yep. So pretty quickly after it sank, there weren't going to be many stories anymore about it.
No.
Because it was all out war.
Yeah. The world's attention turned elsewhere.
Just turned to something big. And I think another one part of it is part of what you said, the newness of the Titanic, right? It was a super height ship.
Yeah.
That was on its maiden voyage.
Yep.
That adds impact to the story. I think the fact that while the Empress had some notable passengers that you went through, there were no Astors or Guggenheims on board.
No.
Right? There weren't, like, of the time superstars.
That's right.
Names that we still recognize now, they were so big. And I think some people like the unsinkable Molly Brown, right, was a socialite. So many of the survivors were known in high society, so their stories got a lot of airplay.
Yeah.
Right, on the Titanic?
Sure.
And to your point, I think it's actually the big, and then I'll say one sad thing and a little admission on my part. The big narrative here is, it was called the Titanic.
Right.
It was advertised as unsinkable, right? I think it became a symbol of the hubris of mankind and the vulnerability of technological achievements.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we've built this. We've defeated nature.
Yeah,
right? It's like hubris, God laughs, bonk, you know, sort of thing. To the point where they're so sure they didn't have enough lifeboats on the boat.
Yeah, the Titanic, like, purposely, well, we're not going to need them.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
And finally, and sadly, maybe the public was less engaged because they already had a Titanic.
Right.
They already had the tragedy. Mm-hmm. Right. And I just think about myself, right? And when mass shootings first started really becoming a thing in my lifetime.
Oh, God.
I used to like watch and dive in.
Yeah.
And I have to admit to you, Mike, if I'm flipping through the news right now and I see another mass shooting, I kind of go, oh, another one. And I keep going.
There are so many, like, honestly, right now, I think you're right about this.
I can't engage emotionally anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that had something to do with it. So much stuff about the Titanic. It's like, oh, another sinking.
Yeah, surprise, there was another shooting, mass shooting in the United States. I mean, it's...
Or anywhere. Right?
Or anywhere. Yeah. I mean, it happens very rarely in other places, although it does happen. But Reddit post after Reddit post... I follow news on Reddit.
Okay.
And there are a lot of mass shooting in this place, mass shooting in that place. I don't click anymore.
No.
But I'm the same as you are. When Columbine happened, I remember watching that on
all
the news. It was like watching in real time on CNN, the feed from the local station there in Colorado.
Yeah.
And the one young fellow with his... who had been shot in the ankle or something like that, trying to get himself out the window.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember that scene so well. But now it's become so common.
And I don't not care for people, but I can't be crying for humanity all the time.
No.
Right? You have to let it go and go, you know what? Nothing I can do about it.
Yeah.
It's not even in my country. I can't even like affect any issues, and I just got to let it go. And I think maybe that was the case with this story as well.
Yeah.
Sort of, there was a lot of news of the Titanic just 2 years before, and maybe they're over it, right?
Right.
As a public.
Yeah. Very, very, very interesting story, though.
It is, and I now want to see a movie made out of it.
There probably is one. Well, I just didn't dig that far.
What was the... Well, like, no, a big one, though, with...
James Cameron directing.
We'll get a different Cameron to do it.
Cameron
Diaz.
Yeah, let's get Cameron Diaz. Bring her out of retirement to direct a movie. Oh boy.
Ah, yes, the magnificent Trolley Sourbright Crawler, also known as Trollicus brightolus. The worm's captivating neon colour makes it an easy, gummy prey.
Trolley!
It's a surprisingly sour, invitingly chewy, staggeringly snackable species unlike anything else found on this planet.
Eat me!
Delicious. Visit Trolley.com to shop now.
Trolley, eat me!
If you're looking for a smoking gun, I can absolutely guarantee you, you will not find it.
In October 2001, a series of letters filled with a deadly powder called anthrax were dropped into the U.S. mail system. What started as an unprecedented case turned into an unsettling mystery. Who sent these deadly letters, and why? From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up Season 4, The Anthrax Threat. Available now.
That's right. It's time for voicemails. You can leave us a message at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you. Let's see who called us this week.
Well, let's listen to our first voicemails because I am curious to see who called us this week.
Hi, my name is DJ. I'm from Nanaimo, BC, but I live in Red Deer, Alberta. And I love your podcast. And I just want to say that you guys have brought me through a lot of really dark times, especially through the whole COVID shit. But my God, you guys are amazing. And I love the fact that you're from BC and that you're from Vancouver and you know all my favorite places. And I just want to say thank you so much and go take a poop in your duke. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks, DJ.
Thanks, DJ. From Nanaimo?
From Nanaimo. She probably knows about the bars. Yeah. But
she's a DJ.
She's a DJ.
She is what she plays.
So, okay, there you go.
A little reference to Bowie there.
So it's
you.
DJ DJ.
I am a DJ. I am what I play.
When I hear...
DJ the DJ.
When I hear the word DJ, I always think about the Smiths, or is it the Smiths song?
Hang the DJ.
Hang the DJ. Well, we don't want to do
How
that.
How about last night a DJ saved my life?
Yeah, that's a good one too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your praise.
Thank
we really
you, DJ.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Straight out of Nanaimo.
Straight out of Nanaimo. All right. Here is our next voicemail.
Hello, Mike, Matthew, and of course, Mr. Steve. This is Ruth in Fort Worth, Texas. Thank you so much for your podcast. You make me laugh and think. I so appreciated your episode on the Canadian caper. I've seen the movie Argo, but after hearing your recounting of Canada's amazing involvement, all I can think when it comes to Hollyweird is never let the facts get in the way of the American ego. I'm proud and grateful to live next door. Now, go shit grandly in your 10-gallon hat.
Oh, wow. I don't know if I'm able to fill up a 10-gallon hat, but anyway. Grandly.
Grandly.
Well, thank you. I've been to Dallas, but I didn't get to Fort Worth. My friends, I have a couple of friends, actually, that live in Fort Worth, so maybe one day I'll get there. Maybe.
The Fort Worth.
So what does this caller... do Ruth? There in Fort Worth. Yeah, what does Ruth do in Fort Worth?
I was going to talk about the Book of Ruth, but I don't think I will.
Okay.
I think that she is a honky-tonk dance instructor.
A honky-tonk? So teaches line dancing and stuff like that?
Teaches the art of honky-tonk dancing to eager students.
Wow.
In the greater Fort Worth area. The hub of two-stepping and country music revelry.
Well, there you go. Someone's going to do that. I'm always afraid to dance in public.
Yeah, I went to a gay bar once in Texas.
You went to a gay bar, Matthew?
In Texas?
Are you trying to tell us something?
Nothing that you don't already know.
Okay, so you went to one in Texas. Whereabouts?
Austin.
Okay, yep. And
it was a cowboy gay bar.
Oh, dear.
Where they were actually dressed like, it's the first time that I didn't feel like they were dressed like the YMCA. Like if you go, if you go to a gay bar and somebody's just like a cowboy in Toronto or New York, sure. It's like,
it's like a costume.
And it was just real, real cowboys dancing.
Just regular guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Kind of hot.
Oh dear. Anyway, moving on. Here's our next one.
Hi, my name is Casey. I'm actually a U.S. citizen who is currently living in Winnipeg. And I just wanted to call and say that I really appreciate your April episode about drug laws and regulation in Canada. Because I was at lunch today with one of my Canadian colleagues, and I got to drop some fat knowledge about the history of, you know, cannabis regulation in Canada. And it was super fun that I got to be a little bit more informed than the person I was having lunch with. So I would just like to say that I would encourage you guys to, honestly, if you're into it, maybe do a little bit more history or Canadian, you know, fun stuff. But anywho, thank you so much, and I really appreciate what you guys do. And I guess, well, we don't call it a toque in the U.S., so I guess to leave a weenie in your beanie, I don't know. It's gross weenie. Either way. Anywho, have a nice day.
Leave Bye. A weenie in your beanie.
Oh, dear. So what do she and her colleague do for a living, Matthew?
Insurance.
Well, that's exciting. What kind of insurance?
Well, there's a big insurance company in Winnipeg.
Sure.
And it just suddenly occurred to me, but that maybe that's why she's up here. In the peg.
In the peg, yeah.
Maybe it's insurance.
Insurance, okay.
But? She rocks it, though.
Yeah, of course.
She makes insurance fun. What she does is she, like, She specializes in insuring weird things.
Okay.
Like if you have, you know, like a glass bust of Elvis Presley and Marie Antoinette, you have to go to her because she knows how to appraise these sorts of weird things.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's insurance, but it's Casey's insurance, so it ain't boring.
There you go.
That's it for this week's voicemails. Again, you can leave us one at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you, even if it is just to say hi and to tell us to go shit in our hats. If you're stumped for what to chat with us about, a quick story is welcome. All right, we have one Patreon shout-out to do this week, and that person is Nettie Cook.
Hello, Nettie Cook.
Nettie Cook. It sounds like somebody I'm probably related to. It sounds like such an East Coast of Nova or South Shore Nova Scotia name, Nettie Cook.
Does it?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it really, really does.
Okay.
But where does Nettie live?
I was going to say she's in Idaho.
Well, there you go. Okay.
Because I do not know names from the East Coast, really.
Okay. So Nettie Cook is in Idaho. And what does Nettie do there in Idaho?
She's a Sasquatch hairstylist.
Oh, okay. So it's not something to do with potatoes, so that's good.
Yeah.
Hairstylist for Sasquatch.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, you know.
You know there's more than one, right?
Of course.
It's estimated to be about 20,000 in North America.
Estimated.
Yeah, and she does their hair.
All of them?
Yeah. So, you know, when it's Sasquatch prom time, she does the hair, you know, weddings and funerals. Yeah. She even does dead Sasquatches at funerals. Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Like the makeup too?
No.
The hair.
Her sister does makeup.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Nettie Cook.
Thanks, Nettie. And thanks for keeping the Sasquatchians shining.
Exactly. That's it for patrons. And we don't have any donut money donors this week, but we love you.
We love you all anyway.
Thanks to all our patrons and Donut Money donors past and present for your generosity. It helps to keep the show going. You can become a patron of Dark Poutine at patreon.com/darkpoutine. For a one-time donation, you can send us donut money via PayPal using our email address, darkpoutinepodcast@gmail.com. If you don't already subscribe to the show, it would mean a lot if you did. You can easily find Dark Poutine on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. If you haven't gotten yours yet, my book, Murder, Madness, and Mayhem, is available to order via a link on the Dark Poutine website. And speaking of darkpoutine.com, please check it out for show notes and other cool stuff. We'd appreciate it if you took the time to give Dark Poutine a like or a follow on Facebook and Instagram. Most importantly, thank you for listening, and tell your friends about us. Word of mouth is a powerful thing. All right, until our next episode, don't forget to be a good egg and not a bad apple.
Because there's too many of those already.
Oh my gosh, so many.
Bye.
Bye.
I said to my parents, don't trust her, they wouldn't listen.
Every family has a secret.
Joy Delaney, mother of four, has gone missing.
From the author of Big Little Lies comes a chilling new mystery to W.
You are an emotional chaos sinkhole, Amy, and I'm sick of it!
Starring Annette Bening.
Nobody can break your heart like your own children.
And Sam Neill.
She will come back.
Here we go, strap in.
Apples never fall. All new Thursdays, only on W. Stream on Stack TV.